Welcome once again to our discussion of the Creed of Nicaea from the Council in 325 that was carried on until the Council of Constantinople in 381 when the Creed was really, we would say, gelled and completely clarified after much discussion and much theological opinioning. Finally, the Church made a definite decision. So we're in the Nicene Creed, which we as Catholics say every Sunday at Mass, almost every Sunday at Mass, after the homily. We're up to that beautiful phrase towards the end, where it says that we believe in one holy, Catholic, and apostolic Church. And as Catholics, we've always said those are four distinguishing marks that Scripture talks about that we could identify and that we do identify as the Catholic Church. It's one, it's holy, it's Catholic or universal, and it's apostolic. So my guest again today is Ron Eldred, professor of theology and church history at John Paul II Catholic High here in Terre Haute in the lower level of St. Patrick's Rectory. I'm Monsignor Larry Moran, the pastor emeritus of St. Patrick's after 20 years. Ron, welcome once again. So we are on the Church is apostolic, one of the four distinguishing marks. Let's talk about what does that mean, the Church is apostolic.
Of the apostolicity of the Church, the Catechism says, I'm going to quote again, quote, the Church is apostolic because she is founded on the apostles. In three ways.
Okay, and we're talking about the 12 apostles that Jesus selected.
Right.
Okay.
Number one, she was and remains built on the foundation of the apostles, the witnesses chosen and sent on mission by Christ himself. Number two, again I'm quoting from the Catechism, with the help of the Spirit dwelling in her, the Church keeps and hands on the teaching, the good deposit, the salutary words she has heard from the prophets. Three, she continues to be taught, sanctified, and guided by the apostles until Christ return through their successors and pastoral office, the College of Bishops, assisted by the priest in union with the successor of Peter, the Church's supreme pastor.
Okay, so those are the, maybe you can summarize that in just a moment, the three ways we see the Church as being apostolic or connected with the 12 apostles that Jesus himself personally chose and mentioned in the Scriptures in several places.
That's correct. To summarize, that she was founded upon the apostles and their preaching, and because she is governed by the successors, the bishops and the popes. So that's one of the summary statements there. And then I might add that the present pope is the 264th successor of St. Peter. There have been a total of 265 popes, of course, including Peter.
Okay.
And any good history book traces the succession down through the ages. In fact, I teach a history class at the high school, John Paul II Catholic High School, where we actually trace through a lot of these popes. We don't go through all of them, but as we go through history, it's the same history you get in let's say at South or North High School or some other secular school, except there's just a lot more emphasis upon the role of the Church, which, of course, the Church played an extremely prominent role in world history. And if you leave it out, you basically have left the heart and soul of the history of the world out.
Okay, and this has always been a terribly important teaching about we need to go back and keep that unbroken line to the apostles, and that's why when a priest is ordained or when a bishop is ordained, they usually have three bishops, so to make sure that unbroken chain from the first 12 apostles continues down through the successions of the apostles or the bishops after them. And that's one of the Church's concerns about some churches have lost their apostolic orders or handing on by the imposition of hands the power to be apostolic. And then you can, am I correct in saying you can find in any library, Britannica, Americana, a list of all those who claim to be Pope over the 2,000 years from St. Peter to presently Benedict XVI.
Oh, yes, all 265.
It's just a matter, actually, of history.
Sure.
Now, some people, of course, say, well, we don't believe that Jesus gave that power to Peter, and so we don't, that doesn't affect us. But I know an awful lot of people, when they see those, that unbroken succession of Peter, Linus, Cletus, Clement, on down to John Paul II and Benedict XVI, they're really, when you see it right there printed, 264 or 265 popes, as you mentioned, including St. Peter, it certainly never seems to impress me, fails to impress me.
Certainly very impressive.
Well, okay, is there any way that we, other ways that we can identify what we believe to be the true church with the fingerprints of Jesus, the Catholic Church, besides these four clear statements, it's in the scriptures about the church would be one flock and one shepherd. It would be holy. It would be Catholic or universal. And it would be traceable to the apostles. Is there anything else that, as Catholics, we use to help ourselves know that the church really is what the catechism claims it is?
Well, I mean, there's quite a few things in addition to the what we call the signs or the marks of the church that point to the church being the true church. For example, just the antiquity of the church itself. It's one of the longest institutions that's been in existence all throughout history for the last 2,000 years.
In good times and in bad.
In good and bad, and I can't think of any other institution that's been around that long.
Okay.
You can study ancient history, and they're all gone, and they've been gone for centuries. Some could say, well, how about Judaism? Well, that's true, but Judaism, of course, we Catholics believe, is the was the precursor to the Catholic Church. The Old Testament, as St. Augustine told us back in the 4th century, prefigured the New Testament.
So as Catholics, we believe that we are, our roots are in Judaism.
Yes.
And it flowered in the New Testament.
That's correct.
The teachings of Jesus.
Another thing, the survival of the church in spite of the countless assaults on her throughout the ages.
And you would say both exterior and interior.
Oh, yes. In fact, sometimes the worst enemies of the church are the members of the church itself.
We become our worst enemies.
We become our worst enemies.
There have been bad bishops, bad popes, bad priests, bad Catholics in and out through history.
Yes. The fact that the teachings of the church have never changed for over 2,000 years. And there has been what we call the development of doctrine, and that's something we can't go into right now because it's too complicated a subject, but essentially, the teachings today are the same as they were 2,000 years ago, and as Jesus himself, of course, had taught.
And many, many people have found their way to the Catholic Church by reading the early writings of the 1st century, 2nd century, 3rd century, and seeing it's the same thing that the Church is teaching today.
You maybe think, you mentioned a while ago about the, when we were talking about the longevity of the Church, the church has continued to exist in spite of its sinful members, including even a few popes and bishops over the centuries. Another thing is the church's phenomenal growth throughout the world. There's hardly a place, probably no place in the world where the church doesn't exist somewhere. Even in India and China and Japan and Korea and many, many, many other places, there are the Catholic Church exists in these places.
And I think we talked about it a little bit before, but I'd like to repeat it again, that wherever we would go, let's say to understand the teachings of the Catholic Church in Tokyo, Japan, or in Berlin, Germany, or in Rockville, Indiana, the Catholic Church would be teaching the same fundamentals around the world and from the beginning, going back to the early church.
Yes.
And that seems to be some kind of a miracle in itself.
Yes. I think another factor is the holding power of its members. Another would be the unity of the faith, which is sort of what you were saying a while ago, in worship for over two millennia. The fruitfulness of its charity, such as hospitals and orphanages and schools and aid to the poor and hospices, and you could go on and on. The church has always been there to serve the poorest of the poor.
I think Mother Teresa is just a modern example of the type of dedication of people, St. Vincent de Paul, and you keep going back through the early hospitals and using orphanages and care for the poor. That's always impressed me, the tremendous works of Jesus, who said, go out and feed the hungry and clothe the naked. And even our own Catholic Charities here in town has an amazing outreach to a wide radius of people, particularly feeding the hungry.
Another would be the sanctity of millions of its members over the centuries. The church provides the means with which to become holy, to become like Jesus, to receive and to keep sanctifying grace. There literally have been millions and millions of saints over the centuries, not just the canonized saints. Anybody that goes to heaven is a saint, and just some of them for various reasons, because of their fame or because of various reasons. They're the inspiration they can provide for others. The church declares that certain souls are in heaven.
Well, I would always consider, and I think many people would, my mom and dad who died, they weren't saints in capital letters, but they were certainly saintly people, and that I would fully expect them to see God face to face in heaven. May have had to pass through purgatory a little, but the church is capable of helping us be saintly people if we just listen to his teachings and use the wonderful, hear the word of God as the church preaches it, and then, of course, the sacraments, like the sacrament of penance, sacrament of Holy Eucharist. Well, is there anything else that...
Well, I'd like to add one more thing, and that's just simply the countless miracles attributed to the intercession of the church over the centuries, just literally millions of them. I'm not just simply thinking of the great miracles associated with the great apparitions, such as Lourdes or Fatima or Guadalupe, but even our own community. And God works miracles through the intercession of the saints, and especially the Blessed Mother, whose feast day of the Immaculate Conception happens to be today, December the 8th. Just literally probably tens of millions of where God has intervened and caused someone to be cured or come back to the faith or to get the faith in the first place or whatever.
One of the things that's going to happen in next year, apparently for sure, is the canonization of Mother Theodore, the foundress of the Sisters of St. Mary's of the Woods, and because they finally got another authenticated miracle, and they haven't said a whole lot about it because they're waiting for, I think, it being authenticated, but at least what I heard, it was accepted, and we'll be hearing more about that at the beginning of the year when the canonization of Mother Theodore foundress of St. Mary's.
And that is, as you know, a very rigorous process to prove that actually a miracle did really take place. And we are hoping that sometime to have a series on apologetics where we'll get into that subject and look at that in some detail. What are some of these criteria and what have you?
And hopefully in the year 2006, whenever Mother Theodore is canonized, we might be able to have a whole program on her wonderful life and what she accomplished, which was almost a miracle in itself. Okay, anything before we kind of go on?
Well, I think there are some other factors that of a different kind. For example, the church provides, I think, the best explanation for evil in the world. I've never, all the reading I've done over the years and discussions I've had with people, and I've never found anything that explains why there's evil in the world, why bad things happen to good people and all that kind of thing is the explanation that the Catholic Church has. The Church provides the best, I think, explanation for who we are and what our destiny is. The church provides meaning and purpose to our lives, I think, as no other institution has ever done. The church provides the best explanation for suffering and sorrow and death, I think, ever devised. The church provides the only reasons for hope in a world, I think, of darkness and despair. The church is one of the few institutions in the world that fosters a culture of life. And finally, I think another one that comes to mind is the church is one of the world's few institutions that teaches objective morality and traditional family values.
Okay, and what do you mean, Ron, by objective morality?
A truth that exists outside of our own minds, our own subjectivity, our own opinions.
Okay, so doesn't just they just don't take a vote and see how many people
right.
are in favor of this, and then that makes it true or false.
In other words, that truth really is outside of ourselves.
In other words, the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, and those things are objective, fundamental moral laws that aren't going to change.
Right.
Okay, let me just throw this in, because I know that you're a convert yourself. Did you find that the Catholic Church provided the best explanation of evil and who where we come from and where we're going, best explanation of suffering, sorrow, and death?
Well, I pretty well got to the point that Cardinal Newman or John Henry Newman got to, that it was to a point where it's either Catholicism or atheism. And
that's a pretty dead end. Yeah, I mean, you're at the fork in the road.
In other words, you eliminate all of the other. And I never did dabble around with any of the Eastern and New Age kinds of spirituality and that kind of thing. They always seem foolish to me, still do.
So
I think there certainly is a lot of truth, and I don't want to get too much into my own religious background and my family, but at this point anyway. But certainly is a lot of truth in the Protestant religions. They certainly have retained a lot of the teachings of the Catholic Church.
Well, and even the Council talked about that there are seeds
yes.
of the gospel in the world religions. But what you said, you got so to a point where you were sort of ready to give up. There isn't any answer, or the Catholic Church is the answer.
Yes.
So that's a powerful experience. We'll get a chance to talk about that sometime on a whole program, I hope. Well, can you summarize what we said about the Catholic Church and why we believe is the true church that Jesus set up?
Yes, going back to Cardinal Newman again, Newman had this term that he called the illative sense.
Illative?
Yes, and I found myself doing that even long before I ever read about Newman's illative sense.
And you're quoting Cardinal Newman, the great convert in
yes.
the church at the end of the 19th century.
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, it was in 1845 is the year he actually came into the Catholic Church.
Okay.
He didn't die, though, until about 1890, something like that, at the age of 89, almost 90 years of age. But I think any one of these factors that we have given, and there's a whole lot of them. We talked about the one holy Catholic, not the signs, you know, the marks. We talked about maybe 9 or 10 other factors, and then we added another 5 or 6 to that. So altogether, I have about 15, maybe 20 different things here that any one of them by themselves may not be overwhelmingly convincing. But if you get all of them put together, the weight of it is so overwhelming, and that's what essentially I think that Newman meant by the illative sense.
What does illative mean? Combined or
something of that sort?
Never heard
yes.
that word before. Okay.
It's not in the dictionary. At least I didn't find it in the dictionary. I've got some theology dictionaries, but I'm sure that it has some Latin root or
sure.
a Greek root that would mean something similar to that. But in my opinion is that if a person finds all these things out and I think
it he becomes
would,
magnetic.
Yes, I think he would be a fool if he didn't come to believe that the church is the true church and want to be a part of that, and at the same time live one's life in accordance with that belief.
Okay, except you would agree, would you not, that faith is a gift, and a person could do all this reasoning and see all these truths and still actually maybe not make the step because they really haven't had that special gift from God.
I've read about the scripture scholars and historians and philosophers, and I'm knowing a few knew an awfully lot about the church and an awfully lot about God, but didn't really know God. And because, as you said, faith is a gift, and the only way you can receive faith is to open yourself up, using your will to make a decision to open yourself up to the infusion of God's grace. Because faith is what we call a theological virtue. It's an infused virtue. And so that's the only way we can really get it. But again, you have to open yourself up to it to receive it.
And normally, under the present dispensation, it seems that if we don't pray, and I know several people who finally got to the situation, they would say something like, I know one guy, famous convert, who went to Montmartre, the Mount of Martyrs in Paris, France, and they have all-night adoration there. And he knelt down and he prayed and he said, God, I don't even know if you exist, but if you exist, please help me. I am really in trouble and I'm in the dark. So prayer would be a normal, a necessary part of our conversion to God and to Jesus and to the church.
Well, you look at the saints that were great intellects, such as Thomas Aquinas, probably one of the smartest men that ever lived, the angelic doctor. At the same time, he would spend literally hours every day in prayer or in participating in the sacraments because of the graces, of course, that he obtained from that. And I think that's true of any great doctor of the church or any great theologian of the church or any great historian or even historians and theologians today. If you look at the ones that really are the smart ones, the ones that you really admire, the ones that you say, that guy really has something, you know, or that lady or that woman really has something, they all of them have a very deep prayer life and meditate on these things. It's not just a matter of studying for the sake of knowledge. That can make a person arrogant. A know-it-all, a smarty pants. Mm-hmm. What you need to do is, when one opens oneself to God's grace, then hopefully with that will become humility. And most of the people I've ever known of that type are usually very humble people, yet knew more 100 times, 1,000 times more than any other person knew about that particular subject.
And just to take 3 examples of what you're saying, the 3 great women doctors of the church, Teresa of Avila, Catherine of Siena, and Teresa of Lisieux, boy, their prayer life, as you said, was intense.
Oh, yes. And none of these women were educated, with a higher education. Mm-hmm. Yes, they spent an enormous amount of time. And in fact, what they wrote about was their experience. It was their confessors, I think, in almost every case, particularly with Saint Therese of Lisieux, or with Saint Teresa of Avila, both of whom I've studied quite a bit, and it was their confessors, or the person they went to for spiritual direction, that ordered them to write down these things that they wrote, whether it was Saint Teresa and her autobiography, or some of her other few works that she wrote, or Saint Therese of Lisieux. Because what they were doing is writing about their experiences
of God, not just knowledge of,
right, and not in other words, knowing God. And I guess the spiritual directors saw that, hey, there's something that other people need to, they need that too, and so they weren't academic type of intellectuals like you think of theologians and almost all of the other doctors of the church. Of that 33 doctors, they were relatively uneducated by the things of the world. I might add that I think there's a movement now to include Cardinal Newman, who we've been talking about.
Really?
His name pops up every once in a while as a doctor of the church. I wouldn't be surprised, because John Paul was very, very influenced by Newman, and so is Benedict, Pope Benedict. So really? That would be something I would certainly welcome.
Wonderful. Okay, well, you want to go on?
There are a few other things I would like to say about the church before we... none of the other world religions except Christianity, Judaism, and Islam claim to offer divine revelation and that their founders intended to establish churches.
Okay.
Christianity is, of course, a fulfillment of Judaism, and at least we Catholics believe that.
Sure.
And Islam is an amalgamation of Christianity, Judaism, Zoroastrianism, and Arabic paganism. Certainly, I think a Muslim would partly agree and partly disagree. All Protestant denominations have human founders and were not established until the 16th century and afterwards. Only the Catholic Church fully satisfies the four marks of the true church that we talked about earlier in an earlier session, established by Jesus Christ to convey his revelation and to provide the means of salvation for the human race.
I think pardon me, I just want to get in there because this seemed to be so often discussed, Ron, that the Vatican Council II said that in the Catholic Church is the fullness of the teachings of Revelation. Not denying that there is truths in many Protestant faiths and the like, but that the fullness of the faith or the fullness of the teachings of the Lord are found in Catholicism.
Yes, only the fullness of faith is found in the church founded by Jesus Christ, and we call that the deposit of faith. And all of the graces needed for salvation are channeled through the Catholic Church. We call that the deposit of grace. And we'll get to a little bit later, try to explain why that we think that's true. But when Jesus instituted his church, he gave it his teachings to preserve, transmit, and to interpret. It's an interesting fact, though, that the three religions that profess a belief in the divine revelation and a belief in one God, that is Christianity, including Catholicism and Protestantism, as well as Judaism and Islam, are affiliated in a very intimate way. All of these religions are spiritual descendants of Father Abraham. All of them together make up over half of the world's population, fulfilling God's promise to Abraham that his descendants would be numbered as the stars in the sky and the sands in the sea.
So each of those branches, Judaism, Catholicism, including Protestantism, as you mentioned, and then, of course, Islam, go back to the Abraham of the Old Testament. And that's why I believe Pius XII said that as Catholics, we are spiritually Semites. We are related to Abraham. We're children of Abraham.
We're all spiritual children of Abraham, yes.
Okay, well, any final words you want to say? Because our time is running out on us.
Well, I think that the most important thing of all the things that we're, I think, discussing in about the Nicene Creed is the things about the church, because the church verifies the truth of the rest of the creed. The creed wouldn't be worth anything if it wasn't for the church. It's the church that verifies the truth of the creed, just as the church verifies the truth of the Bible. In fact, the church wrote the Bible.
Okay.
So
For us as Catholics, we can't really separate Jesus and the church.
No.
That they're the heads and tails of the coin of our faith.
Looking at my own experience, going back 50 years almost now, looking at the Bible, yes, the Bible's a wonderful book, yet it could be nothing but a full of fables and myths and this and that and the other if it weren't for the church verifying the truth
authenticating
of the Bible. And this is the way I came to the church, and I think if you study the life of Cardinal Newman, that's what you
certainly are a great advocate of Cardinal Newman,
yes.
As I am too. Well, Ron, our time has run out on us, so thanks to all who are listening. Hope we can be with us again next time. And may God bless you all in all ways and always.